listening to the Diplomats podcast on Asian geopolitics. First of all, I want to open by wishing all of our listeners a very happy new year and all the best for 2016. It's been a great year for us here at the Diplomat, and we're looking forward to continuing our work on Asia into the new year. In any case, I wanted to do something special for this podcast to wrap up the year. So today I'm joined by my colleagues, Shannon Tiezi, our managing editor, and Katie Putz, our special projects editor. Thanks a lot for joining me, guys.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's good to
Yeah,
wrap up
always
the
good to
year.
join in.
Yeah, it's good to wrap up the year with a podcast with my always smart colleagues at the Diplomat. And actually, today's podcast, we're going to focus on a very simple question. And that question is, what will Asia look like on New Year's Eve 2016? So what we're going to do is we're essentially going to run the gamut of these regions that we cover at the Diplomat, and we're going to lay out some predictions that are hopefully informed predictions based on what we've observed covering the region in the past year and even before that, and hopefully give you an idea of what to look out for in the region and what to expect going into the new year. And I actually recently just wrote an article on some things you can expect to look at in January, which I'll link to in the description because I think the year is actually going to kick off with a lot of interesting events around the continent. But anyways, we'll dig into things in a little bit more detail on this podcast. So Katie, as our special projects editor, you work on the magazine. Do you want to tell the listeners about the latest issue of the magazine, which actually has a very similar theme to this podcast?
Yes, so the January issue of the magazine, the cover story is really pretty massive. What we did was we asked the editors and a number of our regular contributors what their expectations for 2016 are across different regions. So I think there are 13 authors in total. So that's a fairly massive article, and it really presents a very comprehensive view of what we think 2016 is going to be like and some of the major trends. So that's definitely worth checking out.
Right, so if you want that outlook in written form in great detail, definitely take a look at the magazine, which I'll also link to in the description to this podcast. So we're going to do our prediction sweep a little geographically. So I actually want to start in mainland China, and that's where I'm going to turn things over to Shannon since she's been covering China all year and probably has some very interesting predictions of where things are headed. So Shannon, I guess maybe let's split this into, domestic economic policy in China and then foreign policy. What's your, one big prediction for where, economic reform or domestic policy in China is going to go over the next year?
So this is kind of the million-dollar question. I think this year is going to kind of be the make or break year for determining just how serious Xi Jinping is about economic reforms. You had the third plenum back in 2013 was where they laid out their blueprint for how they want to go about this economic restructuring process. Progress has been pretty slow, and not unexpectedly so. This is a massive transition we're talking about, and it's only been a little over 2 years. But 2016 is where we're going to see how serious they are about it, mainly because the 13th five-year plan is going to come out and be officially approved in early 2016. So once that happens, you can really look at it and see just how much of this reform process they've kind of codified in their goals for the next 5 years, for 2020. And we've already seen a really big push on one aspect of economic reform that's been very understated so far, which is dealing with the overcapacity issue. China has just massive gluts in certain of its basic manufacturing industries like steel, cement, glass, and that's partially because these are, state-owned conglomerates that can continue churning out these products without having to worry too much about being profitable, which is a major problem for China's economy. And already they've been talking a lot about this as their major economic goal for 2016. The problem with that, obviously, is as you start cutting production at these plants, that could lead to massive unemployment problems for China, which is something they absolutely don't want. So my prediction is that we're going to see some progress. It'll be a lot slower than a lot of people in the economic sphere would like to see, but politically, I don't think they can move overly quickly. There'll probably be just enough progress for them to claim victory on December 31st, 2016, to say that they've dealt with these overcapacity issues, but it's not going to move as quickly as people would like away from dependency on these really construction-driven industries that just aren't profitable anymore.
And another issue that I would maybe add on, somewhat of a positive, but I guess again it's a mixed story is the story of the yuan, which is becoming more of an international currency than it has ever been. I mean, it wrapped up, the currency wrapped up 2015 on a downward note. The year essentially saw the currency devalue after the PBOC intervened after the stock market crashed over the summer. But with entry into the IMF's special drawing rights basket of currencies, and also now Chinese sovereign debt is available for purchase in London, denominated in yuan. I mean, I think that'll be another trend to watch as well going into the year. Because really, I mean, this year was the story of the dollar. The dollar ended the year way better off than pretty much any other currency, particularly emerging market ones. So that'll be also another thing to watch about China. It'll be a real barometer of the Chinese economy, I think.
Exactly. And I think the story of the renminbi is going to be particularly interesting because China has just recently started kind of pulling back from some of these international trading schemes because it's making the value of the currency more volatile than Beijing would like to see. So I think 2016 is going to be the story of Beijing figuring out how to actually handle these changes that we saw happen in 2015, and how it wants to maybe tweak its currency policy or get used to the new normal where it can't control the value of the currency as tightly as it's used to.
Okay, so let's move away from domestic and economic issues in China. And I do want to talk a lot about the foreign policy and security policy, but obviously we're not going to be able to treat this topic in great detail because obviously there's a lot of depth. And I do also want to wrap, the East China Sea and South China Sea disputes into this because that has become such a big part of China's foreign and security policy, particularly in the past year. So Shannon, where do you think, first of all, China's, what are we supposed to look for in Chinese foreign policy in the next year?
Okay, so my big prediction, which might be totally wrong, but who knows, is I think we're going to see a fairly quiet period in the early part of 2016 when it comes to the South China Sea disputes. China tends to kind of go in cycles where it has periods of friendship and outreach, particularly, dangling some economic incentives to its neighbors in Southeast Asia. And then after it feels like relationships are stable enough, it generally moves into a new phase of pressing its claims in the South China Sea. So I think right now we're in the early stages of another phase of China trying to rebuild the relationships. We've seen a lot of outreach to Vietnam over the past year, trying to rebuild that relationship since the oil rig incident of 2014. But we've also seen some small signs of rapprochement with the Philippines, with Xi Jinping visiting Manila for the APEC summit and also sending Wang Yi, the foreign minister, as his envoy prior to that trip, which was the first time that Wang had ever visited the Philippines. There's some slight hope there that they can start to make some progress on their relationship outside of these territorial issues. What this doesn't mean is that China's going to make any concessions or go back on any of the moves it already made. But I think if Beijing gets its way, we could see a fairly quiet beginning of the year when it comes to the South China Sea. And obviously, that'll be dependent on some other factors. If the US conducts a second freedom of navigation operation in early January, that might change Beijing's calculation. But my thought is that they're going to lay low, wait to see what happens with this arbitration case, which should happen sometime in mid-2016. We'll see that decision coming down. And that's going to really be, in my prediction, the impetus for Beijing to re-enter this phase of more aggressive, assertive moves in the South China Sea, because they've set the playing field for themselves to have a very negative reaction to that. There are these almost hysterical commentaries in People's Daily about how unfair it was, how this wasn't a case of international law, but was just trying to steal China's territories away from them, and China would never let that happen. So they're really laying the groundwork for a decision against China on its Nine Dash Line claims by the Arbitral Tribunal, and then being able to use that as an excuse for a new phase of expansion, particularly the possibility of, as we've discussed many times before, an air defense identification zone in the South China Sea or some move to put military equipment on its artificial islands.
Yeah, I think, I I think I disagree with very little of that, if anything at all. I think that's absolutely right, especially what you said about the cycles. And we've already been seeing that actually in the East China Sea. Just last week we saw reports of the first armed Chinese ships within the 12 nautical mile zone of the Senkakus in the East China Sea. I'm looking forward to seeing how the United States and Japan will expand their cooperation in the South China Sea as well, which is probably also going to be a result of, Japan's security legislation from last year, which sees the country eventually transitioning towards playing more of an active security role. And I think we'll see that manifest in the South China Sea, definitely. Okay, so I think in the interest of time, obviously there's a lot more to talk about when it comes to Chinese foreign policy and these maritime disputes, but I want to move things over a bit, very quickly stopping in Southeast Asia to talk about ASEAN. So ASEAN, actually today, New Year's Eve, is declaring the creation of the ASEAN community, which includes the ASEAN Economic Community, an intercultural community, and it's just essentially a series of initiatives intended to improve interconnectivity, people-to-people exchanges, and economic connections and trade between the 10 member states of ASEAN. So I think that'll again be a trend to watch going into 2016 because, if anything, we'll see ASEAN's promise as a single unified market possibly emerge next year. But obviously, don't expect ASEAN to emerge like the European Union did in 1993 after Maastricht. This is a very different sort of endeavor, simply due to the differences between ASEAN states as a whole. But I think that'll be something to watch as well, going into the new year. Okay, and since I'm the South Asia editor, Shannon, can I turn it over to you to play host for the South Asia portion of this podcast?
Sure. Oh, that's a nice change of pace. So, Ankit, I would love to hear your thoughts on this interesting rapprochement we saw between India and Pakistan just in the past week or so. How do you think this is actually going to play out in 2016? Is this another false start, or is this the beginning of a serious change in the way the relationship works?
Well, thanks for asking me, Shannon. No, I think it's there's been a lot of effusive commentary, particularly in India and Pakistan, about this meeting. And for listeners that might not be aware, on Christmas Day, on his way back from Kabul, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, he claims, decided, in the spur of the moment, to land in Lahore, Pakistan, where he dropped in on his Pakistani counterpart, Nawaz Sharif, blessed his granddaughter's wedding, and wished him a happy birthday. And it was entirely a personal visit. He wasn't there really to discuss policy, but there were a lot of cameras around, and they caught pictures of Modi, bear hugging Sharif, the two of them walking hand in hand and grinning. And if you've been watching the subcontinent, that kind of imagery between the leaders is very rare. And it's something that a lot of people have said that only Modi could do, because he's this kind of, dynamic diplomat who likes to inject India's diplomacy with his personal touch. Now, look, you always have to have a healthy dose of skepticism when it comes to rapprochement between India and Pakistan. We've seen a lot of false starts in 2015. I mean, in Ufa, Russia, when both leaders met on the sidelines of the Shanghai Cooperation Meeting, they issued an agreement that a lot of people thought at the time indicated that we'd see some big changes, but again, ended up falling apart. So now, again, going into the new year in January, we are going to see foreign secretary level talks between the two sides, and foreign secretary level talks have been canceled in the past under the Modi government. So if these ones stick and they're productive, and we see, a signal that Pakistan is willing to talk about some of the issues that India really wants to discuss with the government, which include, Pakistan-based terrorist groups that are hostile to India, and the treatment of Hafiz Saeed, the mastermind of the 2008 Mumbai attacks, among other things. If we see sort of some headway on that, I think the ground could be there for comprehensive peace talks in 2016. I think I'm definitely not confident enough to say that that will be something to watch out for in 2016, that comprehensive peace talks between India and Pakistan will be on. Because if they are on, it's a historic development. It would essentially indicate that the two countries are moving towards making more progress on bilateral peace than they have since their independence in 1947. So that is a very strong claim to make about the relationship, and I'm not confident that I can do that right now, particularly because the India-Pakistan relationship is also very vulnerable to external variables, and that mostly means, terrorist attacks, skirmishes along the border. We've seen sort of, a downtick in skirmishes along the line of control in Kashmir. But if those pick up again, if there's firing from both sides, it'll be very difficult for the leaders to engage politically because, they'd be eviscerated by opposition parties in their own countries. What I do want to also point out is that this latest rapprochement seems to have the blessing of the Pakistani military, which is a significant development because in the past, a big reason peace talks have fallen apart is because the Indian government approaches the civilian government in Pakistan, which is not entirely the gatekeeper of the country's foreign and security policy. That's the army. But it appears that General Rahil Sharif, the chief of army staff, has given his blessing to this current rapprochement with India, which is also a positive sign.
So another aspect of this that's related but also separate is the potential for restarting peace talks between the Afghan Taliban and the Afghan government, which obviously Pakistan is playing a huge role in and India is quite invested in as well. So Ankit and Katie, you can also contribute to this as well, obviously. What do you think about the potential for those? And again, this is sort of deja vu all over again. We had these start and then fall apart in 2015. Is anything going to be different in 2016?
Katie, do you want to kick us off on that?
Okay, so regarding peace talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban, I'm not terribly optimistic about it. I mean, I think there's a level of hope attached to these things, but I think there's also, especially in Afghanistan, some exhaustion. And I think you saw that when the intelligence chief sort of quit in a huff recently. And I think, but on the other hand, China, the United States, certainly at the Afghans, and at the moment the Pakistanis are interested in seeing some sort of progress, whether the Taliban is cohesive and coherent enough to sit across the table. I'm not certain who that's going to be. What do you think, Ankit? Do you th are you with me? Are you optimistic or are you pessimistic?
Look, I mean, it's very difficult to have covered Afghanistan in 2015 and not end the year on a pessimistic note. We've definitely seen a backsliding. I think the fall of Kunduz in September was a really big wake-up call for the Afghan government in particular, and now we're seeing reports from the United States that the Taliban holds more territory in the country than it has at any point since 2011. So clearly, the situation on the ground and on the battlefield is dire, and the Afghan government can really waste no time in, heading back to the negotiating table with the Taliban and hope that something sticks. That said, we don't, the government does not have a good record of negotiating with the Taliban, and the Taliban doesn't have a good record of keeping to what it agrees to at the negotiating table, particularly because the Taliban isn't a monolithic group that has a clear, command and control structure where it can, where if Mullah Mansur issues an order saying that cease all fighting, you're still going to have splinter groups of the Taliban that are going to ignore that and, keep on, maintaining territorial control. So the whole idea of having an agreement between the government and the Taliban is just a very difficult project in itself. That said, I think it's a good thing that talks will happen because I think we do see a dip in the fighting, and that will benefit, I think, the Afghan government more than it can benefit the Taliban in some ways. Although it also will benefit the Taliban, depending on, the latest offensives. Particularly if the Taliban suffers a major defeat on the battlefield. A break where the two sides are talking is actually more beneficial for them. But right now, it seems like the Taliban has the upper hand across a lot of the country. And it'll also be worrying, because we'll be heading into the spring, then heading into the summer, which is a historic fighting season. The Afghan government can expect things to get a lot more brutal on the battlefield. But there are a few other variables that I think will be interesting for observers to watch in 2016. And one of those is actually India's growing cooperation with Afghanistan. In November, India agreed to sell Afghanistan military attack helicopters, which was the first time New Delhi agreed to give lethal weaponry to Afghanistan. Hamid Karzai had really pushed for that when he was the Afghan president, but New Delhi was unwilling to go that far, particularly because that would upset the balance with Pakistan, which is very sensitive to that sort of thing. But now it's interesting because you see Afghanistan and New Delhi making this agreement, but then Pakistan and the Pakistani military are still on board for peace talks. So it seems like the Pakistanis, at least, aren't linking growing Afghan ties with India to their support for peace talks, which is positive. So I think that'll be something to watch. And I think the United States' policy will also matter quite a bit. We've seen, General Campbell push for a slowdown in troop withdrawal, and I think he doubled down on that recently, this past week. So if the Obama administration, which is on its way out, decides that the pace of withdrawal will slow down even more in Afghanistan, I think that'll be a positive sign. But again, I'm skeptical about what, 9,800 troops can really do on the battlefield, if that can really make a difference. So I guess to answer your question, Katie, I'm pessimistic, but I think there are, reasons to think that Everything is not lost for Afghanistan, and that the government can recover going into the next year. So, Katie, finally, after Afghanistan, let's head up a bit into the mainland and talk a bit about Central Asia, which is the region that you've been covering for the past year. And Central Asia is a region that, a lot of people don't really keep at the top of their radar when they're thinking about Asia, but it is an incredibly significant region, particularly because, it connects in some ways Asia to, the West. And it connects Asia to Russia, and you have all these former Soviet states. So, Katie, so what is your outlook for Central Asia going into the next year? What are we supposed to look for? What can we expect?
I looking well. So first of all, 2016, the states of Central Asia will celebrate 25 years of independence. So it's been 25 years since the fall of the Soviet Union. So I expect throughout the year there's going to be a lot of reflection, especially by regional watchers, but also by people who had been watching the Soviet Union and sort of the aftermath of its dissolution. There's going to be a lot of reflection regarding what's happened since, in terms of economics, politics, democratization, and security. Unfortunately, I'm not terribly optimistic about Central Asia in 2016. The economic situation will probably persist in this kind of malaise that's linked very deeply to Russia's economic problems. China's slowdown doesn't really help much. The overall oil market is not really great, and so the states of Central Asia that are dependent on hydrocarbons are they're seeing their main source of income kind of dry up, and having to reevaluate how to form their budgets based on much lower oil prices than what they had thought even a year ago. On a political front, there's not going to be terribly much change, with the barring the unexpected death of some of the older leaders in the region. Islam Karimov, I think, is going to be 78 in 2016, and Nazarbayev is going to be 75 or 76. And so, barring an unforeseen death, there's not really space or an expectation of any kind of political change. That said, because of the economic situation, I would expect crackdowns on opposition and dissent to be on the harsher end. Those two things tend to go hand in hand. When the economic situation isn't great, criticism of the state is not appreciated. And on the security front, there's going to be continued talk, especially about ISIS in Central Asia. I'm on the skeptical end of the reality of some of those threats. The leaders in the region are quite convinced that there's a pending invasion. And so, they'll have their eyes on Afghanistan and the security situation there, and I think that's reasonable, but I'm not entirely convinced that they're at risk. I think they have bigger things to worry about in terms of the economic situation. To sum it up, more of the same in Central Asia in 2016, sad to say.
Sad to say, yeah. And I think I actually had missed that it was the 25th anniversary of their independence next year, so that will be interesting to watch. Great. Thanks a lot, Katie.
Thank you.
Well, Shannon, thanks for taking over as host for those final couple sections. I appreciate it. I guess that wraps up our regional tour of predictions. Like I said, Asia is a huge place, and we wouldn't be able to touch on everything. And we'll definitely be posting a lot of what to expect in the next year on our website. So do keep an eye out for that. So like I said at the beginning of this podcast, a very happy new year to all of our listeners, and we'll be back in 2016 with more podcasts and more content at The Diplomat. Thanks for listening.